Rolling. So elections. I thought of talking about the presidential election. And of course, all you need to do is just draw upon your memories of what took place last year. Presidential elections are the marathons. Technically, they begin right after the midterms. Although, truth be told, typically, the ball starts rolling right after the previous election. When candidates start thinking about whether they're going to run, and they start trying to organize their campaign team, and they try to solicit donations. But really, it kicks off after the midterm elections when candidates begin to announce. And then they begin campaigning, crisscrossing the country. Then there's the primaries that take place all throughout the winter and spring, which culminates in the national conventions, where basically the president and the vice presidential candidates for the general election are chosen. From that point, August, going forward, you have the general election. And the general election culminates on that first Tuesday after the first Monday in the first week of November. 50 separate elections in one day. Very different than the primary campaigns because you have Democrats versus Republicans. We talked about the coattail effect that a successful presidential candidate can have. If the candidate is popular, he can help members of his party get into office. He can help governors get in. He can help state legislatures get in. Of course, if you recall, there are rallies, there are speeches, there's media events, there are debates, generally. This past year, there were only two. Although, because of the COVIDs, in 2020, there also were two. But there is nothing in the Constitution that says there has to be debates. The first debate took place, Kennedy versus Nixon. But after that, I don't think there was another debate until 72. Because again, there's no requirement for it. And to be honest with you, in this modern age, the debates are... I don't necessarily know if they change people's opinions. Because I think by the time you get to September, October, I think most people have already made up their minds who they're going to vote for.
So that was the first, actually put together commissioned debate was Kennedy Nixon?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
They didn't have stuff on the radio before that?
No, never.
Huh.
Never. In fact, you go back maybe 100 years, there weren't even primaries. So, I mean, this is all just stuff that's developed because of changes that occurred in society. But again, if you are a nerd and you're interested, the Nixon-Kennedy debate is online. And just listen to how in-depth the candidates were able to get in their answers compared to what we've heard over the last few election cycles. Although, whew, you could also listen to the Biden-Trump debate. You know, that was interesting. The Kamala-Trump debate.
American history that night.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so that would be an exception. You know, generally, like I said, most people listen to the debates. They like echo chambers. They want to hear their candidate say the things they want to hear to get them all fired up. But yeah, that Biden-Trump debate, that changed the course of history. That is hands down for sure. And that will be memorialized in history books in generations to come.
They shouldn't have let Biden speak after a while. Like, they shouldn't have brought him on, in the public.
He was running for president.
Yeah, they've
kept him in the basement for 4 years. I mean, again, I'm not doing the Democrat versus Republican thing. I'm just being straight honest. If you go back and look at how he was handled, media coverage, how he was handled, he would go in, he would read from a script, there would be a big teleprompter. I got a friend that's in the Secret Service. They had, whenever he spoke at the podium, there was a 50-inch TV that was about 10 feet away from him. And everything was scripted. The moment the script was done, he would not be allowed to answer questions.
Yeah, that's why they shouldn't have let him.
Who in their right mind, not let him run?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you meant let him speak.
No, like...
No, you're right.
He wasn't in the right state of mind.
He had not been in the right state of mind going back. Again, my buddy said even when he ran in 2020, he was gone. You know, again, he had brain cancer. That's something that was not covered. He had a tumor removed from his brain. So, you know, do you really want... I mean, this is something future generations have to consider. You know, why was that not covered heavily when he was running in 2020? Why was the other actions that he did? Like, he used to sniff little kids' hair.
Yeah, it's so weird.
Yeah, it was very weird. And there's hundreds of pictures of it. There's video clips of it. Why was that not covered? Well, the media. The media in our country, overwhelmingly, 90 to 95% is pro-Democrat, anti-Republican. So I think that's why Trump lost in 2020. Because if you go back and watch the way the media spun what was going on in the country, you know, I mean, heck, the whole George Floyd thing, that should have never triggered what had happened. You know, but for the media's hatred of Trump, and they spun the coverage, and that caused people to get angry, rightfully or wrongfully, take to the streets, protest, break things, riot, kill people. I mean, it was chaos. But it was all fake. It was all media driven. The media has been described by Trump and others as the enemy of the people. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I know there are some good reporters. But the problem is as we go forward, they're becoming fewer and fewer, because they become activists. You know, at the end of the day, you put the window up, you know, it's cloudy. That's the way the news should be reported. They should report based on what is there, not their opinion. Well, let me think. Okay, well, it's my opinion that, you know, maybe it's not really true cloudy, you know, it's maybe like 50%, because this is what I think. But again, the media doesn't make that distinction. Oh, one other thing, and if you do doubt what I'm saying, it doesn't take much Google work to find the positive and negative coverage of a Democrat candidate versus a Republican candidate. When Kamala was going against Trump, the media was 95% negative Trump, 85% positive Kamala. Why? Is that fair? Is that accurate? You know, I hate to break it to you. I've never met a Republican who was a Nazi. I've never met a Democrat who was like, we'll say, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong level communist. Most people you will meet, 90, 95%, they're a little left, they're a little right. But when you have this instigation, obviously it impacts the way people go to the polls. Now here's the funny thing, just to roll things forward. This is exactly why the Founding Fathers gave us the ability to counter outside influence on our presidential election process. They created the most brilliant system to select a national leader. Why? Because it's based upon checks and balances. The process is based on checks and balances. I'm not trying to be controversial. I'm trying to be accurate. When I tell you, we do not have a democracy. We do not have a democracy because the Founding Fathers understood what democracy actually is. Democracy is based on majoritarianism, mob mentality. I want this, and I'm going to get enough people to get what I want and screw the other guy. In a democracy, the majority always wins, and there's no safeguards. There's no protections for the minority. And again, we're not talking racial or gender, and we're not, that's not what I'm talking about, majority, minority. It's the people who are for something most, and the people who are against it the least or less. Well, the founders knew the vast majority of human beings act with their hearts. They act emotionally. Very few of us have the ability to be rational all the time. Heck, it happens to me. And again, I spend a lot of time, whenever, before I talk, I always try to think out what I'm going to say. But every now and then, so like a little thought, you know, pops in my brain and I get all fired up. I get energized, rightfully or wrongfully. It's part of being human beings. But if you're going to go in and you're going to make a decision based upon who's going to be the leader of this country, what happens if you are motivated by passions? Again, I'm doing the extremes. Republicans are Nazis, Democrats are communists. If that's what you are getting fed because of your little bubble that you exist in, you're the influencers that you watch when you watch your little YouTube videos or your TikToks, if that's all you're getting, you're going to have an unrealistic perception of the other person, the other candidate. So, if you make your decision purely on that, are you taking the time to think, well, what about my own guy or gal? You know, okay, I know I'm supposed to hate him, orange man bad. But what is my guy or gal actually for? And if I support them, are they going to do things that are actually going to help me? Or am I just rage voting? I've been told I have to hate this person, so I'm going to vote against them. You know, I don't have an answer for that. I don't have a solution for that. Nobody does. But in part, that was the motivation behind creating the Electoral College. To give the country a chance to negate a wrong decision that was motivated by passions. So how does it work? On election day, when you go into the voting booth and you get your ballot, and this only applies to president, the candidate's name is there. The party's name is there. But what you are actually voting for are for a group of electors chosen by the party, whose task it is to vote for president. Now, Massachusetts has 11 electoral votes. We have 9 congressmen and women, congressmen and congresswomen, and we have 2 senators. 9 plus 2 equals 11. Every candidate that's on the general election ballot, the Democrat, the Republican, the Libertarian, the Constitutional Party, the Green Rainbow Party, whatever, they all have electors in their party that have been chosen by the party who will have the ability to cast the vote for president. All right. The people meet. Well, actually, no, I see it. I'll get to it. I got to finish this first. So once the electors are chosen, the electors then cast their vote for president. Now, why did they do this? Well, originally, before the states put laws into place, originally the electors, once they were chosen, could vote for whoever they wanted. So what happens if a Democrat is voted for by Massachusetts and then 2 weeks later it comes out that the Democrat is an actual agent of China, a Manchurian candidate?
Well, in the founding fathers' minds, that would give the electors a chance to basically say, no, I'm going to vote for somebody else. Because the people were lied to, the people got it wrong. Every single state, every single party, chooses their own slate of electors. Which technically means, technically speaking, there are 538 people. That's it. 538 people who vote for president. To win, you have to get the most of those 538 votes. The magic number, 270. Quote, ironically, we're talking about Elizabeth, about this dude, Alexander Hamilton. He wrote in Federalist 68, and I quote, "It is equally desirable that the immediate election should be made by men most capable of analyzing the qualities adapted to the station and acting under circumstances favorable to deliberation and to a judicious combination of all the reasons and inducements which were proper to govern their choice. A small number of persons selected by their fellow citizens from the general mass will be the most likely to possess the information and discernment requisite to such complicated investigations." In other words, if you don't know jack shit about what the president does, what's going on in the country, what's going on in the world, the founding fathers believed you should not actually decide who is going to be the leader of the free world. But instead, you should have a say in picking somebody who maybe knows those things. So you're going to let them make the decision.
Go back to what we talked about in the beginning of the semester. Plato's Republic. That was the whole argument that Plato had. The vast majority of people are naive. They're uninformed. They're ignorant. Why would you let those people decide who is going to be the leader of your country? So, you have this system. You're supposed to be able to get the best results. Questions? All right, I said that. Majority to win. The magic number is 270. All right. How it works. On the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, the people go to the polls and they vote for the electors that have pledged to support the party's candidate. Now, FYI, in today's world, states have passed laws that have bound the electors to the electoral votes. It's not all states, though. There are still some states that still allow the electors to have their free reign. Once the votes are tallied in each state, you know which party's electors are going to vote. The electors then meet a month later in December. Typically the second week in December. And the electors meet in their states and then they cast their ballots. Now, of course, don't forget, I did throw it out there, but I want you to put it into your notes. The electoral votes for every single state is equal to the number of senators, which is 2 for every state, plus the number of their representatives. The biggest state is California. I believe they're down to 53, I think, after the last census. Followed by Texas, Florida, New York. Massachusetts only has 11. Interestingly enough, when I was born, Massachusetts used to have 14. But as a result of reapportionment in the census, when the states lose population, they lose congressmen. And when they lose congressmen, they lose electoral votes. And those states that grow gain those seats. Now, by the way, because of the 23rd Amendment, D.C., the District of Columbia, also gets 3 electoral votes. Now, in terms of the disbursement, every state except for Maine and Nebraska are winner take all. So if the Democrat wins Massachusetts, all 11 votes go to the Democrat. Texas, if it's a Republican that gets the most votes, all of the electoral votes go to the Republican. The only exceptions are Maine and Nebraska. Maine, which has 4 electoral votes, gives 2 votes to the overall winner, and then 1 vote for each of the congressional districts. So I could be wrong, but I think Maine was split. I don't think Kamala got it all. I think it was 3 Kamala, 1 Trump. I might be wrong, I just don't remember. Nebraska is the same, except they have 3 congressional districts. So there's 2 votes for the overall winner and then 3 additional votes, which means one candidate could get 3 and the other one could get 2, theoretically, or 4 and 1, or if it's a sweep, could be 5. Why? Well, it's the states that control these things. Once the electors vote, they then transmit the votes to Congress. The Congress certifies 2 days after the new Congress sits. So obviously the infamous day is January 6th. Now here's the thing. The Congress receives the electoral votes. There is nothing in the Constitution, nor any federal law, that says the Congress has to accept the electoral votes. The Congress has the absolute right to reject the electoral votes, because it's part of the check and balance system. So, think back, did any of you ever learn about what took place in the election of 1876? There was allegations of corruption that the electors in Florida, Ohio, and I think Washington were manipulated and forced to vote for a particular party. Well, reports of that corruption got to Congress, and Congress refused to certify them. So they created a commission made up of, I think it was 7 Democrats, 7 Republicans, and 1 independent. And they went in and investigated. And at the end of the day, they decided that there was sufficient evidence of manipulation in one of the 3 states. Well, as a result of this, the commission decided to give most of the votes to the Republican. Thus, Hayes became president by 1 electoral vote, even though his opponent had more popular vote. Now, by the way, that's what at least a discussion should have taken place on January 6th, 2020.
Now, would it have changed the outcome? Don't know. But Congress was obligated to investigate the claims that there was electoral fraud that had taken place. But then, I don't want to be the tinfoil hat guy, but then the whole thing happened. I don't know if it was actually like a deep state operation or whatever. I don't know. But we know January 6th took place and that process was disrupted. And in the end, Congress just kind of rammed through and said, we don't care. And we're going to throw the election to Biden. Again, that's just the way it played out. And I mean this sincerely. I don't know if Congress would have deliberated if it would have been another 1876. I don't know. But at the very least, the system was designed to give Congress the chance to say, you know something? Something just doesn't smell right. Checks and balances. That's what checks and balances are all about. All right. Now, here's the irony. The way the system works today is different than it was originally intended. Under Article 2, Section 1, Clause 3, originally, each of the electors were supposed to cast two votes. Two votes. They were given a list of known candidates, and they could just pick two. They were not voting for president or vice president. They were just saying from the list of the names, these are the two guys that we think would best serve as president. Now, the only limitation that the Constitution put on that was it couldn't be two men from the same, or I shouldn't say men, let's be more neutral. Although back then it was only men, that's why I said it, but it can't be two candidates from the same state. The Founding Fathers wanted to spread out the candidates. Now, why did they do it this way? Well, whoever got a majority of the electoral votes would become president, and whoever got the second most would be vice president. This system was designed without political parties in mind. Coincidentally, this is kind of what goes on in those jungle primary states. You put everyone's name on the ballot, and whoever gets the top two votes, you know, gets to run. Well, this is the same basic idea. But then a problem came in. There was a problem in the election of 1796. 1796, political parties were forming. It was the Federalist Party, of which John Adams was one of the leading candidates. And then there was the Democrat-Republican Party, of which Thomas Jefferson was the leading candidate. When all of the electors cast their ballot, in 1796, the guy who got the most votes was John Adams, Federalist. But lo and behold, who came in second? Thomas Jefferson, Democratic-Republican. And even though they had been the closest friends in Philadelphia, at the Philadelphia Continental Congress, by the time Adams became president and Jefferson had become vice president, their relationship had been spoiled, contaminated, and they became the bitterest enemies. And the vice president actively colluded against the president. That was problematic. Threatening to tear the country apart. That, of course, led to the successive election, 1800. But in 1800, it was worse. Because in 1800, the top two vote-getters tied. Two men from the same party, Jefferson and Aaron Burr. Both culminated in what could be defined as constitutional crises. So what did they do? Well, Congress went to work and they decided to scrap the original system. And they tweaked it in the 12th Amendment.
Now, under the 12th Amendment, and since 1804, the electors must specify. Candidate A is my candidate for president. Candidate B is my candidate for vice president. This eliminates the likelihood of there being a Democrat president, Republican vice president, and it also eliminates the ability for there to be a tie amongst the top two vote getters. Questions? Yes?
I don't think I knew that Burr was a politician. I just knew that he killed Hamilton. What was his deal?
He wanted to be president. He was a Democratic Republican. He was a politician from New York State. And
he was in the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, he ran and he just wanted to be president. And they just politics. They argued. He actually ended up having a personal gripe with Hamilton. And that's ultimately why he shot him. Because Hamilton publicly insulted Burr at like dinner parties and functions.
Back when we were able to shoot each other was legal.
No, not in New York. Ironically, dueling was illegal in New York. So that's the reason why they had to go to New Jersey. Because dueling was okay in New Jersey. And by the way, on that, just to show you how much hatred Burr had for Hamilton. So they get up and they fire the pistols. All right? Now, back then, you basically bucked up to see who got to shoot first. Because the whole point was to be brave enough to have someone shoot at you. So Hamilton won the draw. He fires his gun, and he intentionally shoots it over Burr's head. Burr, however, takes out his pistol, pulls it, and it misfires. Apparently, Hamilton kind of made fun of him for that. But under the right of duel, if it misfires, you have a chance to shoot again. So he reprimed it, recocked it, and he aimed. Boom! And hit Hamilton down in the abdomen. And I think he would die like a day or two later. The irony was there was a warrant put out in New York for the arrest of Aaron Burr. But because it had taken place in New Jersey, where it's not a crime, they couldn't go and get him. So it's one of those weird things in history. All right. Now here is an interesting situation. We know there was a tie, which led to this. We know there was a split parties, which led to this. What happens if we actually have a situation, we get to a time in our country when we have more than two viable national political parties? Well, if we ever get to a time when we have three, this could actually occur. We could run into a situation where there is no candidate that wins a majority. Now, by the way, it has happened before. Under the original Constitution, this is original. If there was a tie, the House would choose. Each state got one vote. And to win, you needed a majority. Ultimately, that's how Jefferson beat Burr. Hamilton contacted his buddies in the House, the Federalists, and basically did the enemy of my enemy triangulation. Hamilton hated Jefferson for political reasons. But Hamilton hated Burr for personal reasons.
So ultimately, Hamilton convinced some Federalists to throw the election to Jefferson.
Because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Yes?
Weren't they always trying to one-up each other?
Oh, yeah.
Political
thing? Yeah, an unhealthy level of competition. Obviously, that culminated in one guy shooting the other.
Now imagine if they just got along.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a good lesson. Remember, they were from separate political parties. And look at what happened when you allow that partisan hatred to get to the point where you want to shoot the other person. All right. So here we go. I've laid out what happens if a tie. Well, remember, originally under the Constitution, there was no political parties. So what happens if there was no majority? Well, originally, the top five vote-getters would go to the House. And the House would pick one through a majority vote. Originally, the person who got the second most votes in the House would then become vice president. Now, by the way, that had never happened. It's never happened in the history of our country. Why? Because the 12th Amendment changed it. Under the 12th Amendment, this eliminated the possibility of ties. But, as I said, what happens if you have three or more viable national parties? Well, under the 12th Amendment, what happens today is that the top three vote getters would go to the House, and the House would decide based on a majority vote, one vote per state. What happens if there is no majority for vice president? Well, under the 12th Amendment, the top two vote getters go to the Senate. And the Senate decides. But each senator gets a vote. If it's the president and it goes to the House, you vote by state. If it's the vice president, they go to the Senate and each senator votes. Majority to win. Now, interestingly enough, both scenarios have happened in our country's history. In 1800, Jefferson didn't get a majority. We've already talked about that. But it then happened again a generation later. In 1824, there were four candidates running nationally. And none of them got a majority in the Electoral College. So it went into the House, and I don't remember if you ever learned about the corrupt bargain, where basically the election was thrown to John Quincy Adams. Of course, the irony, the consequence of that, was that's what's caused Andrew Jackson to split away from the Democrat-Republican Party and go form the Democrats. What about the vice president scenario? Well, that did happen once in our country's history. 1836. Martin Van Buren had tapped Richard Johnson to be his running mate, but the party, the Whigs, wanted another candidate. So they actually allowed two Whig candidates to run for vice president. And both names showed up on all the ballots. Bless you. So in the end, the contest between the two went into the Senate, and the Senate picked Johnson to be Van Buren's running mate. Has it been close since? No. Could it happen? Yeah. Talk about making politics interesting. Imagine if we had three political parties to choose from, or four.
So, Did Roosevelt run as a third party with Bull Moose?
Yeah, he did. But that's what allowed Woodrow Wilson to get a majority.
Yeah.
So that could have happened. But Wilson got just enough. All right. I think we've talked the electoral vote, electoral college to death. Any questions on the electoral college? Don't be surprised if I ask you a question to explain it all. So hopefully you're paying attention to me more than you're watching TikTok videos. What about this you hear about all the time? Oh, the popular vote! The popular vote! The popular vote! Does not exist for the President of the United States. It's a fabrication. It's a misnomer. Why? We don't live in a democracy. We choose our president based on the Electoral College system. Now, there is popular vote for every other elective office. The people vote for governors. The people vote for their congressmen. The people vote for their senators. The people vote for their dog catchers. But for the President of the United States, there is no popular vote. Coincidentally, 5 times. 5 times in our country's history has the winner that became president, the winner in the Electoral College, received less popular votes than the loser. 1824. Andrew Jackson had the vast, not majority, but had a plurality of the popular vote. But, coincidentally, going into the tie-breaking scene, or the House, he actually had the most Electoral College votes as well. But ultimately, the House chose John Quincy Adams, who was in second place. 1876, the controversy between Hayes and Tilden. Tilden got 200,000 more votes. But because of that special commission, because of the allegations of the corruption, the commission decided to give the majority of the electoral votes to Hayes. And by the way, this election, 1876, is what ended Reconstruction. Because that was the quid pro quo. The Democrats would stop protesting if Hayes, the Republican, came in and ended Reconstruction, which he did. Then, just 12 years later, the election of 1888, Harrison would win in the Electoral College, overwhelmingly, over Grover Cleveland, 233 to 168, but Cleveland ended up getting about 80,000 more popular votes. But then it didn't happen for another 112 years. Fast forward to the election of 2000. Man, what an exciting time to be alive. Florida, hanging chads. Case got all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. Al Gore, former vice president under Bill Clinton, ran for the Democrat side, got 500,000 more votes than his opponent, George W. Bush. But at the end of the day, the Supreme Court said you can't keep recounting and recounting, recounting, recounting. You have to make a decision based on Florida law. And under Florida law, the Attorney General certified the election votes as they were tallied on Election Day. Which essentially meant George Bush became president by 590-odd votes. And then the last one was 2016. Trump wins 304 to 27, even though Hillary Clinton got 2.9 million more votes. At the end of the day, does it matter that Hillary Clinton got more votes? No, because you know where the bulk of her votes came from? One state, California. Now, why do people talk about the popular vote? Well, very simple. It helps in political arguments. It helps in analysis. But at the end of the day, the founding fathers wanted to make sure that we had 50 separate, independent, sovereign states. And they didn't want the urban centers, where most of the people live, determining who's going to be the leader of our country. Because we need to be honest. The people who live in cities have different politics than the people who live in the country. And if we had an electoral system based on the popular vote, the people in the small states, the rural areas of our country, would be completely ignored. And how would that be fair? The electoral college system actually forces the president's candidates, therefore, to not only campaign in a majority of the states, but they have to be responsive to the needs of most of the people. Maybe they ignore some. But at the end of the day, they have to be responsive to most. They have to build a coalition. Because they have to win most of the electoral votes in most of the states. Questions? Now, here is the irony. There is a movement spearheaded by the Democrat Party to undermine the Electoral College. They have created what is known as the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. The goal of this movement, coming from the Democrat Party, is to do an end around the Constitution. The Constitution grants to the states the power, the right, to determine how electors are selected. Most of the states, as I said, require the electors to vote for the way the people voted in their state. Democrats, however, have created this system where the electoral votes would go to the winner of the national popular vote. And why do I say Democrats? Well, since this started in 2006, as a reaction to the election of George W. Bush in 2000, 15 Democrat states, plus the District of Columbia, also controlled by the Democrats, have signed on. They've all agreed, whoever gets the winner of the popular vote gets the electoral votes. This compact has merged together 196 electoral votes. Now here's the thing. If this group is able to add just 84 more. 84 more electoral votes. They will be able to negate the Electoral College by state law. But, Trump won the popular vote. Granted, it's been a while since a Republican has won the popular vote, but Trump won. If in 2028 a Republican wins and they win the popular vote, what do you think the Democrats are going to do in this compact?
Tear it up.
They'll tear it up. Because they will basically guarantee that the Democrat Party is basically done in presidential elections. But of course, it hinges upon the Republicans not screwing it up. And by the way, historically speaking, the Republicans frequently screw things up. So we'll see. The political scientist in me nerds out about this kind of stuff because it's just going to be curious to see how it plays out. Oh, and by the way, since Trump did win the popular vote, I also haven't heard anything about this. You know, it reared up after the 2020 election. They were trying to push, oh, let's get more states. But no more states signed on, so it's going to be interesting to see if this goes away. All right, questions. No? All right, we'll make that screen go black then. And we will switch gears, seeing how we've been talking about political parties, and we will talk about political parties. But we'll also throw in a discussion about interest groups as well. Because I figured out a long time ago, it's very useful to compare and contrast the two. All right, we'll start off with the PPs, the political parties. You know, I probably should have pulled the definition that's in your textbook. But the definition that I have is pretty straightforward. A political party is a broad organization. Political party is a broad organization that is made up of office holders, party workers, activists, and voters. Thank you. I know that was a brilliant point. Political parties, broad organization that's made up of office holders, party workers, activists, and voters, whose goal is to win elections. The goal of a party is to win elections. And what do you get to do when you win elections? Control government. Control the institutions of government. Office holders, activists, workers, voters want to win elections to get those offices. Questions? Got it all? Okay. Then how are they different than interest groups? Well, very simple. Interest group is an organization, yes. But an interest group is mostly filled with activists and other individuals who have common cause. So, I am a member of a special interest group. I am a state and national officer in the Sons of the American Legion. My group has nefarious intentions to assist veterans and to raise money to assist veterans, and to engage in community service to assist veterans. But here's the thing. We gather our data. We report how much money we raise. We report how much money we spend. We report all the events that we engage in. Hours, volunteer hours. And our report from my local American Legion post goes up to the state organization. And all of the posts in the state of Massachusetts, that data is compiled. And then it goes up to the national organization. And then the national organization compiles the data from all of the 50 states. And then our national commander, James LaCourcière, goes to Congress and lobbies Congress to have Congress pass laws to increase benefits to veterans. Are we a political organization? No, but we engage in activism. Now, obviously, our voters, our members, are going to make decisions when it comes election time. Okay, which congressman and which congresswoman or which senator
voted for legislation that's good for veterans. Well, guess what? I can name two of our senators who have voted against bills that's good for veterans. So guess what? I'm not going to vote for them. But no one from the Sons of the American Legion is going to sit in Congress. Because the purpose of the Sons of the Legion is not to control office. It's to lobby, to persuade them to do what we want, to adhere to our goals. So we try to influence, not win office, not hold office. Well, that was shockingly personal. Questions? Like I said, passion. Passions. Not always reason.
Good thing you're passionate about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Could be worse.
I know. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Oh my God, I want to serve the guys and gals who served. Oh, that's awful. What a jerk that Lemanic guy is. All right. What did the founding fathers view? How did they view about, what was their views on political parties? Well, guess what? They despised the idea of political parties. They despised them. They had disdain for them because they equated political parties with intrigue, with manipulation, with corruption. Like I said, the founding fathers understood most people think with their hearts. Well, what do political parties do? They're not filling your head. They're manipulating your passions. They have a corrosive effect on the unity of our country. Essentially, they negate the ability to reason. Again, orange man bad because the Democrats say so. What are his policies? What is he actually trying to fight for? Are those policies actually good for you as an individual? Doesn't matter. Orange man bad. At the end of the day, all a political party is a faction. It's a small group of like-minded people who are trying to control politics, to control the political process. By their very design, what is the root of party? Part. There's nothing that unites people in political parties. The whole purpose is to divide us versus them. Because if you can divide the people, you can manipulate just enough to win. I don't care what source you look at. Whether you want to read the Federalist Papers, you want to read the Anti-Federalist Papers, you want to read their own personal letters. From Washington all the way down, they all of the founders, universally agreed that political parties are destructive to a united country. Washington. Again, if you only read one thing after we're done, please read Washington's farewell address. So much wisdom is in that letter to the country. But in it, great quote. Parties serve to organize faction, to give an artificial and extraordinary force, to put in the place of delegated will of the nation, the will of a party. Often small, but artful, an enterprising minority of the community. And according to the alternative triumphs of different parties, to make the public administration the mirror of the ill-concerted and incongruous projects of faction, rather than an organ of consent, wholesome plans digested by common councils and modified by mutual interests. If you are a partisan, You will never be able to look at your neighbor as equal. And if you cannot see your neighbor as equal, how can you have a conversation? And if you can't have a conversation, how can you reach compromise? The problem that we have is that the vast majority of partisans, and they're small, they're only a small minority of us, are so entrenched that they just want to corrupt everything so that way they can appear to be the popular side. And the truth of the matter is, they're really not.
Now, that's not to say that the founders themselves were not divided. They were. Again, we talked about in the beginning of the semester, you had the Federalists, who were for the Constitution, and the Anti-Federalists, who were kind of disagreeing with parts of the Constitution. Because again, you can't get everyone to agree on one thing. But the difference was, is they were not organized. They were not financed. They were not trying to control the process. They were simply stating their opinion. Guess what? I hate to break it to you. I fucking hate bananas. With a passion. If there could be some type of agricultural genocide that eliminated bananas from the face of the earth, I would applaud from the highest mountain. I absolutely hate them. But you know the worst part is everybody else in my house likes them. So I have to smell them. I have to look at them. I just want to kill them all.
Are you making a point, or do you actually despise bananas?
I really do.
You like your bananas here?
No, I just hate the smell, taste, consistency.
I am extreme in my position, and there is no compromise. I literally, if I get something that has banana in it, I will literally throw it in the trash. Do you want me filling the stocks in a grocery store?
I am so corrupted. I am so tainted. There is no compromise. There is no reasoning with me. Well, now imagine if that was my position on politics. How could we ever build a consensus if the focus is on extremes? And ultimately, that's what parties do. Now, as I mentioned, the first couple of elections, there were no political parties. But because the Founding Fathers began dividing based on policy matters, you know, Hamilton wanted to implement national tariffs. He wanted to give the federal government more power to regulate the economy. Jefferson, Madison, you know, more states' rights guys. What ended up happening is those political arguments would result in coalitions being formed and organized, giving birth to the political parties in the modern sense. This was done in a way to substitute the old original disagreements. So, if you don't think the federal government can regulate interstate commerce, well, guess what? There's a team of people who think like that. So go join their team. Or if you think, no, you don't want the states battling one another, so we should have some interstate regulation. Well, guess what? There's a team for that. Go join with them.
The impact of this was you didn't even have to understand the actual impact of interstate commerce because now you had a team. Well, they kind of think like I think that way. So maybe I'll just kind of go hang out with those guys. And of course, it has devolved. Joe Biden saying, if you don't vote for me, you're not black.
It's one of the most racist statements I've heard in the last 30 years of politics. He actually said that in 2020.
You can do a Google search, you can hear it. He actually said that on an interview. If you don't vote for me, you're not black.
How insulting is that? I know plenty of people of different colors that are Republicans. I know people of different colors that are Democrats. I know people of different colors that are independents. But if you don't vote for me, you're not black. That's the game the Democrats play. They try to divide people based on race. They try to divide people on class. So if you're sitting there and you're thinking, well, I feel like I'm oppressed. Listen, the Democrats are saying the other team are just like the Antichrist. They're literal Nazis. I don't like Nazis, so I'm going to go be a Democrat. We're on the other side. I don't like communists. I want to keep my stuff. I worked hard to get my stuff. Screw the communists. I'm going to be a Republican. It just makes it easy. It makes it easier. The problem is, though, is when you become fanatical about it. So at best, political parties do kind of work towards the broad goals that were favored by the framers. It gives the people a chance to kind of have an impact on local or state or national politics. It also brings order and stability to the political process. Look, I don't have to go out and try to kill my guy who I don't like or the gal I don't like. I can simply join this party and I can vote against them. It also embraces the framers' theory of representation. If you become a Republican and you vote for the Republicans are going to get in office and do Republican things. Or vice versa. So ultimately, it gives the people a chance to give their consent to policy decisions. A republic. But with the good comes the bad. Political parties heighten the differences between voter groups.
If you don't like the fact that I own guns, you're going to vote for the team that wants to take my guns away, even though my guns do nothing to you. Or if you identify as a different gender, well, the other team wants to, what was the language? Oh, they want to kill me or deny me health care. So this team is saying, no, that's all I want. So that's the team I'm going to vote for. It eliminates the ability of people to say, wait, why are you this way? Why do you like what you like? And have a conversation.
It also reinforces voters to react emotionally. Not with this. Again, the easiest example that I can give you is Orange Man Bad. I see it in my Facebook feed. I see it on Twitter. No matter what Trump does, he is the incarnate of the Antichrist. And that's just not helpful. Because nobody is. Trump's not a saint, but he's not the Antichrist. Biden definitely wasn't a saint. Flawed, but he wasn't the Antichrist. But if you are a partisan, you're never going to be able to see the other side. You're never going to be able to communicate with the other side. And by the way, that's what parties want. Parties don't want Democrats, independents, and Republicans talking to one another. Because the moment we do that, we're going to realize, hey, we're all Americans. We all want the same thing. We all want to be able to get a job, make some money, be able to take care of our families, get some nice stuff, go on vacations. I don't care who you are. I don't care how you identify yourself as. We all want the same. And if that's what we could focus on, my God, think how great we could be. So, at the end of the day, if the Founding Fathers would come back, I think, to be honest and sincere, I think they would be kind of like, meh, on what we've become in terms of our political focus, And they would say, yeah, maybe we should take a few steps back. But I don't think they would come out and say, just blow the whole thing up. Because at the end of the day, I think they would be more concerned with the influence of the interest groups, which obviously we'll talk about more next class. Questions? All right. I'm going to stop there because I was very, very talkative today. But again, just when we're all done, you know, when the end of May comes around, do I care if you remember every last little detail that we covered? No. I just want you to get some of these ideas in your head. Because at the end of the day, when we all realize that we're in America and we live in God's greatest country ever devised, you know, we'll all be better off for it. So, today is Wednesday. We are going to come back on Tuesday. That is going to be our last, Monday. I meet with you on Monday. Monday, the 12th. That is going to be our last in-class person. I'm going to try to be less long-winded, get through political parties, get through interest groups, and then I got a video that I've already made on the bureaucracy. I will post, I'll do my best to actually post it early so you can bang that out. Yes?
Is the final being done online?
Yes. Okay. The final will be done. I'm going to schedule it on the day that we're supposed to have it, which is the 19th. So that's a week from Monday, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and how long will we have to take it?
Just like all the others.
Like the other exams.
It's not going to be any longer than anything else.
It's not cumulative, it's just...
It's not cumulative, it's just the fourth exam. And the only difference is it's going to be worth more in your average. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to be any longer. It's not going to be any different instructor design. So you'll get however much time I've been giving you. And, 30 questions, maybe a confusing little matching thing, and a couple of essays.
Oh, that's always great.
Oh, yeah. I get to get creative with this. All right, questions? I hope you all have a heck of a weekend. I'll see you all on a week. No, less than a week. Monday.
I'll bring you a bushel of bananas.
Don't you dare do that!